From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 16th day of July, 2026. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. In Kansas City today, attending a National Association of Farm Broadcasting event. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Matt Bennett. He's at agmarket.net. We'll hear about sulfur fertilizers and the changing needs of the corn crop across the Midwest as it is related to the Clean Air Act, and then we'll turn our attention to the weather forecast, too. Mike Tenura will be here from T-Storm Weather. That's tstorm.net online on that sulfur side. He will be discussing some smoke that is in the air again this season. We'll do all of that right here on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world, online, on demand at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Let's take a look at what's been happening in the marketplace. Matt Bennett is here. He is with agmarket.net out of Windsor, Illinois. Hi, Matt. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I want to start by talking about my travels, at least over the last 24 hours or so. Yesterday, I made my way to the Ore Research Center in Western Illinois. That's on the west side of Jacksonville. The trip from Champaign through Decatur, Springfield, and to Jacksonville on the interstate, Matt, surprised me just a bit because corn looked better than I suspected it should and probably did. I was pretty impressed by that. I pulled off at Jacksonville and then used two lanes from there, and we'll skip past the Bayless or Research Center, but all the way to Hannibal, Missouri then. And the two lanes there run through the hills and hollers and the trees and the farm fields. And that, too, looked really good. And then, finally, across the top of Missouri on 36. I made that trip, Matt, on June 1st and back on June 4 or 5. I don't remember quite which day. All the way to Junction City, Kansas, in the middle of Kansas. The crop on that date looked way better at that point than what we had in Illinois, mostly because it had been planted much earlier. At the time, we had corn in Illinois, two leaf on that route, all the way maybe to knee high. And the corn in Missouri and Kansas was hip high, much of it at that point. It looked really good. I will say this time around that it clearly has probably pollinated, and it appears to have been suffering from the heat. It was a bit spindly and, you know, against the heat of the day, and it wasn't terribly hot, you know, 91 yesterday coming across there. And I'm wondering, when you talk to producers, Matt, what they're telling you about the condition of the crop today and the condition of your crop there in Windsor. That'd be about an hour to the south of Champaign-Urbana.
Yeah, I mean, our crop looks pretty good overall. I think the pattern tiled stuff has a chance to be pretty special, you know, if we can get the right sort of rainfall here over the next couple, 3 weeks on corn, and maybe next month, 5 weeks on soybeans. The growers I talked to, I mean, if we're fair about it, Todd, you know, guys that have a great crop are usually pretty tight-lipped about it. They don't want to tell anybody, but you know, we're hearing a few guys here and there, especially in the Dakotas this week, talking about hot conditions, way too much wind. They're not very happy with how their crops are holding up through this type of heat. I think what it all boils down to is we can all take some heat as long as we don't have super hot nights and as long as we have enough moisture. And right now in central Illinois anyway, it looks like pollination is going to pretty much go without a hitch.
For the moment, are you willing to mostly discount risk premium in the marketplace?
Well, I don't think that the corn market would have been near as strong there on Wednesday if we wouldn't have had, you know, Kansas City wheat up 40 cents and Chicago soft red wheat up in the mid-30s. There's no doubt that that lent some support over towards corn and soybeans. You know, at this point in the game, though, there's no doubt that the trade is well aware that we need that 183 type yield to keep from drawing stocks down significantly year over year. Obviously, having lower acres necessitates that you have an awfully big crop. And as of right now, you know, on the good to excellent ratings, you know, we're running 6% below, where we're at this time last year. So I think the trade's aware that weather needs to really cooperate here over the next 3 to 4 weeks. So, yeah, I don't know that there's a ton of weather premium in this market by any means. I think it's got as much to do with outside influences as anything.
Well, let's talk about some of those outside influences. They are primarily, and there was weather related to France, but I think they're primarily due to both the war in Iran and the war between Ukraine and Russia, and how wheat may or may not be able to move out of the Black Sea, and oil, of course, out of the Strait of Hormuz at this point. How do you view those two?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the wheat situation is that there's no doubt, you know, with some of those bombs flying back and forth, what that's doing is it's elevating wheat prices, you know, and the people, some of the people that are engaged in that definitely have something to gain on the back end of that. You know, I don't know if this stops and a bunch of wheat gets dumped on the world market. You know, I don't know how this thing plays out, but there's no doubt that, you know, it's a very interesting situation, and that's where a bulk of the exportable supplies out of the world, a large percentage come right out of that region. So, you know, that's one thing that could make the wheat market very volatile. But like we tried to tell people here over the last day or so, you know, taking advantage of that for someone that's maybe put wheat in the bin and saw it go up 50 cents to a dollar, it's not a bad idea to maybe take advantage of that. So, you know, and that's obviously spilled over into corn and soybeans. As far as the Strait of Hormuz, you know, the oil market has not skyrocketed up back closer to the highs. You know, you're fluttering around the $80 mark. You know, and with that being the case, it tells you that there's a large part of the trade that feels comfortable. This is all going to iron itself out sooner or later, and that the relief that we've seen in energy prices is something that's going to maybe come back to us. So, you know, I that's just kind of the way I'm looking at both of those situations as of today.
So how do you see corn and soybean and wheat playing out over the next month or month and a half in that case, particularly as we close in on the end of July, if a weather premium doesn't come back into this marketplace?
Yeah, I mean, if weather premium doesn't come back into the marketplace, you know, there's no doubt that you're going to be in a position where you're going to probably take these corn back under the 450 level again if you don't get weather issues to come in. I don't know that we fall precipitously. I don't think there's a lot of incentive for the grower to sell down at that 430 and below level. So your natural seller is probably going to be absent. But at the same time, I think it's going to be really hard to rally if you don't get a weather issue. And then as far as soybeans go, they've just been resilient, Todd, as you know. I mean, it's been such a resilient market. But it's also showed it doesn't feel real comfortable being above $12. So, you know, a person has to understand if they're in a spot where they know they can make money in this type of level right now, they better be paying attention and at least putting in a worst-case scenario.
Thank you much. I appreciate it, Matt.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Todd.
Matt Bennett is with AgMarket.net. Joined us on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. By the way, I'll be traveling back from Kansas tomorrow. So instead of the Closing Market Report, you'll hear the Commodity Week program that I'll record this afternoon in person with Arlen Suderman and Mike Zuzulo. Sulfur has historically played a secondary role in Midwest soil fertility plans, largely supplemented by atmospheric deposition. However, as clean air regulations continue to reduce that free supply, corn producers are reevaluating their nutrient management strategies. Yesterday, during Agronomy Day at the Orr Center in Western Illinois, University of Illinois researcher Blake Link addressed these shifting dynamics. I asked Link about the relationship between corn and sulfur.
Sulfur, in terms of a fertilizer source that farmers require, comes in multiple forms, the most important of which is sulfate, because that's what plants are taking up. So when we talk about sulfur materials in terms of fertilizers, we're talking about things that contain sulfate itself. Think like ammonium sulfate. We're talking about things that contain thiosulfate. Think ammonium thiosulfate in a liquid form. And we're talking about things that contain elemental sulfur. Think Tiger 90 or some sort of pelletized elemental sulfur. Thiosulfate and elemental sulfur require oxidation to become sulfate. That process produces acidity, which farmers need to keep in mind in terms of lime requirements. But over time, they do become sulfate. That time period does depend on the amount of elemental sulfate. Thiosulfate generally becomes sulfate quicker. But all three of those sources are viable sources for farmers to use for S fertilizers.
So as a fertilizer, sulfur has been in the background. Once in a while you hear about it, but it seems today that there's much more discussion about sulfur and its need within the corn production process. I'm wondering whether you think that widely across the Corn Belt, sulfur is in short supply within the soils and that really needs to be added to them.
Well, we can begin that discussion by talking about some soil test levels. We do a soil test survey across the Midwest, and our 2025 data is in. And in Illinois, we're seeing over 50% of soil samples, routinely ran soil samples, come in below 7 parts per million, which would fall in the very low category according to the agronomy handbook. So that does provide some background for us. I would also say, as many people probably know listening to presentations on sulfur, that with the Clean Air Act and the cleaning up of coal-fired power plants, we're getting less sulfur deposited with rain. So the need is growing a little bit. Whether that's translating to a farmer getting a return on his investment for purchasing and applying sulfur fertilizer is relatively unclear in Illinois. There's been some more extensive research done in Indiana and other states, but at least for the confines of Illinois, we've seen inconsistent results, but we need some more time to accumulate a little bit more data to be able to give farmers a better understanding of that question.
Are there parts of the state or soil types in particular that are more likely to be in need should you see on a soil test that it is short of sulfur?
Absolutely. We think sulfur in many ways is analogous to nitrogen, Todd. And I think what's important about that is organic matter, as it mineralizes, produces sulfur for farmers and their crops. So situations where farmers have low organic matter levels, think about coarse textured soil, for example, or loamy soils. Leaching would be an issue there. Those are places where both the supply of sulfur is low and the losses of sulfur through crop uptake, but also leaching and other ways, is relatively high. And in that case, those might be areas to keep an extra close eye on for possible sulfur deficiencies.
What do you tell farmers when you come to an agronomy day like this one about how they should assess the need?
It's difficult to give a good answer to farmers at this point, Todd, about whether they should or shouldn't use sulfur. Unfortunately, we just don't have good statewide data to influence that. What I would say is that it's relatively low risk for a farmer in fields where he suspects a sulfur deficiency might be to do some trials of his own or perhaps contact the Illinois State Fertility Lab or Illinois Extension to coordinate some on-farm trials to test whether sulfur is, first of all, going to influence yield at all, and second of all, going to return the farmer's investment for such a sulfur purchase.
As we began our conversation, you suggested that producers would need to watch the acidity in this process. How so? And how do they test for that? What are they looking for when they're watching that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Todd. It's not so that acidity is some scary thing that we need to be afraid of and so we shouldn't use sulfur. It's more so that it's just an artifact of using thiosulfate or elemental sulfur fertilizers, just the same as we use ammoniacal fertilizers like anhydrous ammonia, for example. Those are also acid producing. So there's sort of an old rule of thumb that for every pound of anhydrous ammonia we apply, we need to think about putting down 4 pounds of pure calcium carbonate or its equivalent in limestone. And in sulfur, a general rule might be 3 pounds of calcium carbonate or its equivalent, although that certainly depends, and we should definitely rely on regular soil testing to evaluate pH and possible lime applications versus relying on these rules of thumb. Just something to keep in mind for farmers when they apply sulfur.
That's Blake Link. He's a PhD student at the University of Illinois under soil scientist John Jones and leads the field research team. You're listening to the Closing Market Report on this Thursday afternoon. Our theme music is written, performed, produced, and courtesy of Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason. Let's turn our attentions to the global growing regions across the planet. Mike Tenura is here. He's with T-Storm Weather, president and CEO there in Naperville, Illinois, and online at tstorm.net. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Let's start and probably stay in the United States today, but begin with the heat that we are now under. What do you know about this heat dome and conditions?
Well, the heat's been centered on the northern and northwestern growing areas. This has really hit the spring wheat crop pretty hard, and also some of the corn and soybean crops across the Dakotas and into Minnesota. It has expanded over the last day or two to include more of the northern half of corn and soybeans. But everybody in the southern corn belt and into the mid-south, they're all saying, well, it hasn't really been that hot here. It's actually been pretty nice. So we do have a divide with some heat to the north that's been ongoing this week, and some okay temperatures to the south. Now, it's going to be kind of the same over the next 5 days because we'll see that heat loosely continue in those same areas, though a cool front or two will kind of mix in with those to keep temperatures down just a tiny bit. And then the southern areas, well, they'll never really tap into the heat. Yes, they might have a warm or hot day here or there through Tuesday, but we have a circulation that's moving northward as we speak, and that will bring some clouds and some showers and storms to these southern areas. So it's kind of a mixed bag, Todd, with, you know, half of the corn and soybean crop saying this is not really great, it's too hot, and the other half saying I don't see a problem.
Not really great, it's too hot, but is it extreme in your opinion?
It was earlier last weekend and into Monday. So Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, we saw highs solidly in the hundreds in parts of the Dakotas and Montana. But again, that was kind of centered more on spring wheat. For most corn and soybeans, it was in the 90s and 70s, which is quite a bit above normal, especially once you start heading that far to the north. But overall, this was not a historic heat wave.
Daytime and nighttime temperatures, 90s and 70s. What do you see next week?
Well, we'll see a cool front move through Monday and Tuesday. So temperatures will drop down for several days. That'll leave highs mostly in the 80s with lows in the 60s, and that'll be for everybody. So it will be a little bit nicer for most of next week.
That sounds like very comfortable weather. When we get further out into the month of August, do things change over that 20-day period?
Well, 10 to 20 days from now, it is a bit of a challenge. We have a couple of different things that we're watching. The heat that we've been talking about is still going to be in parts of the U.S. We think that might include some of the western corn and soybeans during that period. At the same time, cool fronts are going to continue to move through the east, and that'll leave corn and soybeans kind of in between. So the most likely scenario is for some heat west, some coolness east, with most of the corn and soybean crop kind of in the middle, with highs in the 80s and 90s and lows in the 60s and 70s. So that's not ideal, but it's also not a huge problem. It's pretty close to normal. So that's the most likely scenario. Todd, one thing we do need to talk about, though, is rain, because there's not really very much rain on the horizon over the next 5 to 8 days across the plains and the western corn belt. So this area is going to be turning drier as we move forward. Now, we'd be more concerned about it in a normal year, but this year has not been normal in that we've had a ton of rain up until maybe 10 days ago. So overall, we can still ride this situation out, at least based on the proprietary data that we've been analyzing. And these eastern areas are still going to see some rain this week, some rain next week. So kind of that same divide with some of the poorer conditions developing west and some of the okay to good conditions to the east. But the wild card here, Todd, is what happens with rain 10 to 20 days out.
Follow up on that rain forecast a little bit. What do you see 10 to 20 days out?
Well, this is where it gets tricky because we can see a couple of things happening. We can see that the southwest monsoon is going to start up a couple of weeks early. And this is where some quasi-tropical energy drifts in from the Pacific and then gets into Arizona and that whole desert region of the southwest. Once we get into August, a lot of the times those little waves of energy float into the plains and turn into some pretty nice rainmakers. And we do see hints of that starting up as early as 7 to 10 days from now. So we are including that chance for rain. Now, if that doesn't happen, then the likely scenario would be for that rapid temperature contrast from heat west and coolness east to set up the main storm track on top of the Corn Belt. That would also lead to rain chances. So we think there is going to be rain 1 to 2 weeks out. Most of the computer models are not really sure what to make of this, and they're also not really generating all that much rain despite a setup that looks pretty favorable for it. So at this point in time, we think the rains will be pretty close to normal in 1 to 2 weeks or in that 10 to 20 day period.
I do have a final question for you. This is related to smoke. There's always some discussion about what that means for the crop, but apparently we will be seeing more smoke.
Well, we certainly are today. I mean, it's been around and it's been kind of sweeping across parts of the Corn Belt. And so typically what happens, since we've now seen this many of the last 10 years, is kind of becoming an annual thing. But basically it keeps your daytime temperatures down by kind of providing almost like a layer of fog. You have this light fog that's kind of preventing full sunshine from heating the ground and warming up the temperature. So your daytime temperatures get held down a little bit. Doesn't really matter much at night because radiational cooling, which is where temperatures fall a lot at night, that's more driven by the amount of water in the air. It really doesn't have much to do with the amount of smoke in the air. And the other thing it would do is filter out your sunshine. So a corn crop, say on a sunny day, gets 100 units of sun. Maybe now it's only going to receive 97 units of sun because of that filtering. I'm not sure the exact numbers, but you kind of get the idea. So how all that plays out in the yield, we haven't seen anything too unusual in recent years from a yield perspective where something was way out of whack to the high or low side, even though we had a lot of smoke. So probably whatever effect the smoke has on that process is fairly small.
Hey, thank you much. I appreciate it. We'll talk with you again soon enough.
Sounds great, Todd.
That's Mike Tenora. He is with T-Storm Weather. That's tstorm.net online. Joined us here on the Closing Market Report for this Thursday afternoon. Find and listen to the whole thing again anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.